It's a pleasure to be here. I'll be talking about quantum mechanics and the geometry of space-time. This is a brief outline. So I'll give a brief review of black holes, a brief review of gauge gravity duality, a brief review of what we know about black holes as seen from the outside, such as the entropy, unitarity, etc. We'll discuss what happens when objects fall into the black hole. We'll discuss a bit the connection between chaos and the geometry near the black hole. And then we'll discuss some questions about the black hole interior. We'll review the so-called Amps paradox, sometimes called firewall paradox. And then we'll discuss some aspects of two-dimensional black hole, two-sided black holes and wormholes. We'll discuss this idea of ER equal to EPR and the applications of that idea to this paradox. And then we'll finally close with some similarity between tensor networks and space-time geometry. Okay, black holes. So we know that gravitational collapse leads to black holes, and that classically nothing can escape the event horizon when it falls behind the event horizon. So that's classically. But quantum mechanically, we know that black holes can emit thermal radiation. And that implies that black holes actually can be white. So you can have a black hole which is so small that the black hole, as it gets smaller, it gets hotter. And you can have a black hole so small that it can be white. So even the name is wrong. So now, the temperature of a black hole in units where h bar is 1 is equal to, I lost my batteries. Okay, there it is. So it's equal to 1 over the radius of the black hole. That means that the characteristic wavelength of the outgoing radiation is of order the size of the black hole. And that's very small for astrophysical-sized black holes, which are formed with the mass, roughly the mass of the sun. So how big do you think a black hole should be in order for you to see it white? Everyone realizes it has to be the size of the wavelength of white light. Okay, so it's a relatively small black hole, but you can do the calculation of how massive it should be, and actually it should have the mass of about a continent. So still pretty heavy black hole. It's not a nice flashlight. You can even calculate the power that such a black hole would emit, and you realize the power is very small because this black hole will be very small. So it's I think it comes out to be about a milliwatt. So it's visible, but not a really good flashlight. Now, this fact that black holes have a temperature also implies that black holes can evaporate. And the evaporation time is cubic in the mass of a black hole for a black hole in 4 dimensions. And it's very long for black holes which are have big masses, like the mass of the sun. It's about the age of the universe for a black hole that has the mass of a mountain. But this fact that they have a temperature is conceptually important because it also says that the black hole also has an entropy. And we can calculate the entropy by looking at the first law of thermodynamics, which relates the energy to the changes in the energy to changes in the entropy. So we know the energy and we know the temperature. And so we can calculate the entropy and by integrating this equation. And when we calculate the entropy, we find that it's the area of the horizon divided by L Planck. So for a macroscopic black hole, this is a huge entropy because L Planck is very tiny. And one question is, what is the statistical interpretation of this entropy? So we have naively the classical solution for a black hole is just one single geometry. So why does it have an entropy? Now, one sometimes hears the statement that this temperature is very small, so it's irrelevant for our universe because these black holes that are naturally produced have very tiny temperature. This effect has not been seen. However, there is a very closely related effect, which is the generation of fluctuations during inflation. And that effect, the fluctuations certainly have been seen. And one leading theory for explaining them is the idea that they were generated during a period of exponential expansion, where the mechanism that produces them is very similar to the mechanism that produces Hawking radiation. So you could, by a little stretch, you could say that it has already been seen. And not only has been seen, but these fluctuations are crucial for our existence, because if there had been no fluctuations, the universe would be uniform. And there wouldn't be an Earth and a Sun and so on. So that concludes the review of black holes. So now, brief comments about the gauge gravity duality, or sometimes called gauge string duality, or ADS-CFT, or holography. All these are similar names. They mean more or less the same. So the idea is that it is a kind of bridge. So it's a relationship between two different kinds of theories. One is one kind is quantum field theories, or quantum theories. It doesn't have to be a field theory. It could be a quantum mechanical system. So, but the point here is that we have a theory of interacting particles defined according to the standard rules of quantum mechanics. And here we have a theory where we have a dynamical space-time. And it's the quantum version of general relativity or string theory. So here, the space-time is fixed. So these live on a fixed space-time, and so on. So that's what this duality is. And the way it typically works is that, the way it always works is that you have a space-time where you have the dynamical gravity theory. And the space-time has a region far away, some asymptotic boundary far away. And the field theory is defined on a space which is given by this asymptotic boundary. And so in some sense, the field theory lives on the boundary of the space-time. And this is an ordinary field theory, an ordinary quantum system. And examples include, for example, gauge theories, such as Yang-Mills or Chern-Simons gauge theory. And the examples that are known are very specific gauge theories. I will not discuss the specific examples. So for some specific examples, you can work out what this gravity theory is. And if you want, so in general, you get some quantum gravity theory or some string theory. And if you want this to become an Einstein gravity theory, with the standard Einstein-Lagrangian and the standard notion of locality that we have in the Einstein theory, then what you need is that this quantum system here should have large n. So in the cases that it's a gauge theory, the gauge group should be very large. So we have SUN with very large n. So n is the number of colors of this gauge theory. Or in general, you could say that n is roughly the number of fields in the gauge theory, or the number of qubits that the quantum system has. And in addition, we want a reasonably strong coupling, so a very strong coupling. So a weakly coupled gauge theory, a weakly coupled Yang-Mills theory, does not have an Einstein gravity dual. I mean, it might have a string dual, but not an Einstein gravity dual. So always when we, in this talk, we are going to talk only about duals which have Einstein gravity. So you should think of this as a very strongly coupled gauge theory. So if you have this relationship, then you can describe anything that happens inside this space as something that is happening in the quantum field theory. So the idea is that these two are equal or equivalent descriptions of the same physics. You can either describe it using the gravity theory, or equivalently, you describe it using the ordinary quantum system. You don't have both descriptions at the same. I mean, it's not that you have the gravity theory and in addition you have extra degrees of freedom here. Either you have the field theory description or you have the gravity description. So now you can consider things like black holes. So you can consider this one of these examples where you have a space-time with a boundary. These examples, the simplest examples are examples with constant negative curvature, sometimes called anti-Sitter space. Anti-Sitter space is the Lorentzian version of hyperbolic space, so that's why I took this picture of Escher that is a picture of hyperbolic space. And so that's the picture without the hole, that would be just empty space. And then we can put the black hole in it, and we can ask what this is. So this is should correspond to something in the boundary theory, and it really corresponds to a thermal configuration in the boundary theory. So we have the boundary theory at finite temperature. And then, so if it is filters in this case will have a kind of plasma or a fluid on the boundary at finite temperature, and the entropy would be given by the log of the number of states in the boundary theory, or equivalently from the gravity point of view, we would calculate the entropy as the area of the horizon. And in cases where you can do both calculations at the same time, these two numbers agree. These cases include cases of 1+1-dimensional field theories. And also, there is a special case of a matrix quantum mechanics theory where the calculation can be done numerically. So you can do numerically this side of the calculation. I mean, just a comment. In order to compare these two numbers, you need to do the hard calculation that you need to do is to calculate this in the field theory, because as we said, whenever the gravity theory is correct, the field theory is strongly coupled. So you really need to do the calculation in a strongly coupled field theory. And for some special field theories, you can do it, as in 1+1 dimensions. Or in some cases, you can do it numerically, as in this example of the matrix quantum mechanics theory. The other thing that you learn is that if you look at this black hole from outside, so you do any experiment that can be easily interpreted from the boundary theory point of view, such as, for example, you start with nothing, you send a wave that produces a black hole, and the black hole then evaporates. That whole evolution will be unitary because it's because the boundary theory is a unitary theory. So you can translate the original gravity equation to the boundary theory, and then you can evolve in the boundary theory and then translate back to the gravity picture, and the whole evolution done this way would be unitary. So whatever the black hole is doing will have to respect the laws of quantum mechanics. So based on these ideas, you think that even though unitarity appears to not be true for black holes treated in the semi-classical way, it should be that in the exact description, the black hole as seen from the outside should be described by a unitary theory. And there are many things that have been done in this direction. One interesting thing is that there are some black holes that you can construct. So when you have a field theory that has some, let's say it's defined on flat space, then you can raise it at finite temperature, and the corresponding geometry will contain a black hole which has a planar horizon. And then you can imagine doing small fluctuations of this horizon. And those correspond to small fluctuations in the density of the fluid that you have on the boundary theory. And these long-distance fluctuations are described by hydrodynamics in the boundary theory. And you can take Einstein's equations and do the same long-distance expansion in the bulk and find also the laws of hydrodynamics. And so there is a very nice match and very nice derivation of the laws of hydrodynamics of these planar black holes. But you start from Einstein's equations, and from Einstein's equations, you derive the laws of hydrodynamics. Okay? So the Navier-Stokes equation is included in Einstein's equations. So it's a connection between these two classical equations of physics. Okay, but all this is not saying very much about the interior. So I briefly alluded to the fact that it is easy to translate between boundary and interior calculations for things that are near the boundary. But the deeper you get into the interior, it gets a little more hazy. And when you get into the interior of the black hole, really, there is no clear proposal for how to realize the interior on the boundary theory. And we'll discuss some of the issues in a second. So a quick summary. So we think that black holes, as seen from the outside, have a finite entropy. So they are described by a system with a finite number of qubits, quantum degrees of freedom. Their evolution is unitary. If you accept this gauge gravity duality, that's true for black holes that are in ADS, or in systems that have a gravity dual, a field theory dual. But we think that this should also apply for other systems like black holes in flat space or general black holes in general spacetime. And as I said, the gauge gravity duality dictionary is most clear for observations that are done very far away from the black hole, so in this asymptotic region. So you sit far away where there are no big fluctuations of the geometry, and you send some waves. They collide, they form a black hole, at the in the interior, and then the black hole evaporates, and you can calculate what happens. But it's not clear how to describe the interior. So the modern version of the information paradox is to give a unitary description of the black hole, and at the same time, using the same type of variables or the same formalism to describe the interior. So we know that the interior exists using the gravity description, but we don't know how to describe the interior from with the same degrees of freedom that we use to describe the unitary evolution, which would be the field theories on the boundary, the field theory degrees of freedom on the boundary. Now let me comment on one little point that sometimes might be confusing. So let's imagine we have a black hole. So we have a star, let's say, that collapses into a black hole and so on. And we have here someone who's falling into the black hole. Now, so this someone might be sending some signals to the outside world. And from the point of view of someone who stays far away from the black hole, it takes an infinite amount of time for this person to fall in. So the person outside will continue to receive the signals for an infinite amount of time. Right? Or if you describe the black hole in ordinary, let's say, Schwarzschild coordinates, time coordinates, it takes an infinite amount of Schwarzschild time. Of course, the person who falls in feels that there is just a finite amount of proper time that it takes for the person to cross the horizon and fall into a singularity. So the time it takes to go from the horizon to a singularity is of order the inverse temperature of the black hole, so roughly this size of the black hole that we were mentioning before. And that's so very quickly he falls into a singularity. And so classically, it takes an infinite amount of time to fall in. And so sometimes people say, well, since you're always seeing this stuff falling in, and this thing that holds for, so this statement that holds for a person that falls in also holds for the matter that falls in. So if you're sitting outside, it looks as if nothing ever falls in, right? So in fact, apparently in Russia, they were calling black holes frozen stars, I'm told. So because they were viewing them from outside, and indeed takes an infinite amount of time. So then why is there an information paradox? You always see the black hole. You always see the stuff that falls in from the outside. But one important point is that these signals that we are talking about are redshifted. So if you send a signal with a fixed frequency, this guy with a fixed frequency, the signal would be very redshifted. And also any fluctuation, any deformation of the metric and so on, will also decay exponentially fast with a time decay constant, which is comparable to the time it takes for light to travel the distance of order the black hole size. So very quickly, you seem to lose these signals. And not only that, but very quickly, the energy of these signals, and even the energy of the whole object here, is smaller than Hawking radiation, than the temperature of Hawking radiation. And so even if you will be able to send the signals, at some point, the signals are getting smaller than the size than the noise that is produced by thermal radiation. Now, a better way to say this is that the object falling in is a process of thermalization, where you fall into this thermal atmosphere of the black hole, and the object gets thermalized. So that's how we see it from the outside. And it gets thermalized fairly quickly, exponentially quickly. Now there are some nice points that could be said about this thermalization process and the type of dynamics we get near black hole horizons. And this is this you can see most clearly by considering the commutator between two simple operators. These are two simple operators of something we measure outside the black hole. So it could be, these operators could be measuring some mode of the metric. So let's say we measure the size of the metric or the size of a scalar field smoothed out over a region of the order of the temperature. So it's some operator which, let's say, has some eigenvalues of order one. And you can consider two such operators, and you can choose them to commute at time equal to zero. So you could measure, let's say, one mode of the metric and another mode of a scalar field, for example, two different things. And at time equal to zero, they commute. They refer to different fields. They don't talk to each other. And for weak coupling, which we are normally in Einstein gravity, the commutator is one. But the point is that if you were to evaluate the commutator, but after doing some time evolution on one of the operators, then the commutator would become of order one. This is sometimes called the quantum butterfly effect. So the idea that if you make a little change in the system, so you should imagine the black hole is made out of lots of qubits, and one operator changes one qubit, and the other operator changes a different qubit. And the idea is that if you change one qubit at time equal to zero, and you try to see what the effect is on some qubit at very late times, then it will be affected. So all the other qubits will be affected by doing a little change in one qubit at time equal to zero. So it's not that the qubits evolve independently. So if you had a system where the qubits evolve independently, then you do a qubit change in one of them, and then it will not reach the other. Now, this behavior of that this commutator is going to one and one qubit affecting all the others is sometimes called scrambling behavior in the quantum information theory. Quantum information theory literature. And that's what you expect in the case of the black hole. And the reason we expect it has to do with the fact that time evolution, so the ordinary Schwarzschild time evolution, corresponds to a boost near the black hole horizon. So if, for example, let's say one operator corresponds to sending a wave into a black hole, and the other operator corresponds to sending the same wave later, these two waves will have a very large relative boost, And then you know that the gravitational interactions grow when you perform a relative boost. So if you have two particles that collide with some energy, they will have some gravitational interaction. But if you make the energy bigger, the gravitational interaction will grow in proportion to the energy. So as you make the boost, the interaction will grow. Okay. And so this implies, so what you expect for this commutator is the following. So I'm just here trying to summarize in a picture, in more concrete picture, what I was saying in words. So as a function of time, we start with the commutator of the two operators, which is essentially zero. And then it starts growing very slowly with a very small coefficient, which is 1 over n squared in the cases that we have a field theory dual. Or this would be proportional to the Newton constant in units of the size of the black hole. So in other words, this would be a number of order L Planck squared divided by the size of the black hole squared. So this is small because the gravitational interaction is small, right? So the gravitational force is weak. So there is a small prefactor. But it grows fairly fast with time. So this is the growth due to the fact that time evolution corresponds to boosts. So this is this exponential is really the boost factor between the two perturbations. And so we expect that this grows with this boost factor, and eventually it settles down to one when because that's if we have operators whose eigenvalues are plus or minus one, so the biggest, that's the maximum it could be. Okay, very good. Now, it turns out that you can interpret this rise as a kind of Lyapunov exponent, that you know when you have a chaotic system and you have nearby trajectories, they start diverging as with the Lyapunov exponent. And the equivalent in the quantum theory is this growth of the commutators. And it turns out that you can think of this as a Lyapunov exponent. And not only that, but you can argue that this value that you get for a black hole, corresponds to the maximum possible value you could have in some rather generic chaotic systems. So chaotic systems which have Hamiltonians, which act on a few qubits at a time. So so it's a special kind of Hamiltonian, but it's a Hamiltonian that is rather generic, and it's only a Hamiltonian of the form that these gauge theories have. So it's a Hamiltonian which acting on the many qubits, it acts on a few qubits at a time. So the Hamiltonian is a sum of terms. each of which acts on a few qubits at a time. The qubits don't need to be near each other or anything, but just have to be a few at a time. And then you can argue that you have this maximum exponent. This is a bound on chaos that should hold for rather general systems, even those that do not have a gravity dual. So it's a bound that was found first by looking at gravity and then extrapolated to other systems. So in some sense, you can say that black holes are the fastest scramblers, or they are the things that cause chaos to grow in a way that is as fast as possible. Now, much of the discussion about the interior, so I'm now going to start talking more about the interior, is really on whether there is an afterlife. Okay. It's really, so the observer outside sees the person who falls in as dying here. So it gets thermalized with the Hawking radiation. And from the point of view of the outside, that person is dead when it thermalizes with the Hawking radiation. On the other hand, the person falling in feels that he dies further in. Okay, so the whole discussion is whether really we do have this region here in the interior or not. Okay, and so how is the interior realized? And early popular idea was the idea that perhaps the interior is a kind of dual description of the exterior. So you have, from the exterior point of view, you have some degrees of freedom that live at the horizon, and because the entropy is proportional to the area of the horizon, so somehow you have those degrees of freedom there. And then the interior is some dual description of those degrees of freedom, some approximate description of those degrees of freedom. But if you try to make that a little more concrete, AMPS realized that when you try to embed the interior in the space of microstates of the black hole in a state-independent way, I won't describe exactly what that means, but subject to the standard rules of quantum mechanics, you find that you cannot do it. You run into some paradoxes. So I'll explain one of the paradoxes. So I'll describe now the so-called AMPS. So AMPS proposed four paradoxes by my count. They all call them firewall paradoxes, and they describe them as proving that black holes have a firewall. I don't like that description. I view them as different paradoxes, and so I'll describe one of them. So this is the one in the first paper. So the first idea is that to imagine that you have a black hole which is maximally entangled with a second system far away. So we said that the black hole has a number of microstates, so and as any other system that has a certain number of microstates, that system could be entangled with another system far away. Okay. So if you have a spin a half particle, you can entangle with another spin a half particle or with something with more than with more degrees of freedom, you can certainly entangle it. So how can you do that with a black hole? So the idea is that you can do this by forming, first you form a black hole from an almost pure state, and then you let it evaporate for a very long time so that more than half of the entropy of the initial black hole was emitted into the Hawking radiation, so that the final black hole has less entropy, has less area, than half the area of the initial black hole. So after that happens, you end up with a situation which is the following. So you have, this is the state, the black hole after this process. So this is not the initial black hole, but the black hole after a long period of evaporation. So you have the black hole and the radiation that was emitted far away. And the idea is that these two, the black hole will be in a state with close to maximal entanglement with the early radiation. Now the question is why? So the idea is based on some argument by Page, where he says, well, the typical state in a product of, so suppose you have the idea is that the evolution of the black hole and the radiation is a rather generic affair, and therefore it will tend to produce a state which is a random generic state in this product of Hilbert spaces, where HA is the Hilbert space of this black hole, of the black hole microstates, and HB is the Hilbert space of radiation far away. And in the situation we have, the dimension of this Hilbert space is smaller. This is the entropy of the final black hole. This is much smaller than the dimension of the outside, which is carrying all this entropy, which is more than the entropy of the original black it's more than the entropy of this black hole we are considering, because we have let the original black hole evaporate by more than, so that it lost more than half the initial entropy. And so in this situation, you take a random state here. You can argue that the entropy of the reduced take the density matrix reduced on this factor, on the factor, on the first factor, then the entropy of that density matrix will be close to maximal, close to the dimension, to the log of the dimension of HA. So that's the argument that we have maximal entanglement. You can run the argument even without maximal entanglement, but it's a little more complicated. I prefer to do it this way. So we have that situation. And now let's consider some Hawking radiation mode. So this will be some Hawking radiation mode with a frequency comparable to the temperature, so that we have 50-50% chance of it being occupied or unoccupied. So we can, or close to 50%, could be a fermionic mode just for simplicity. So it can either be occupied or unoccupied. And so it's coming out here. And this late radiation, if we have something close to the vacuum here across the horizon, then we'll have some inside partner that will be another mode. And they together will form a pure state. And that pure state is just the pure state of the vacuum, in of the local vacuum of Minkowski space here. Okay, so that's what should happen if the black hole horizon is smooth. So these two will be close to maximally entangled, or will be exactly maximally entangled. Well, will be close to maximally entangled. And that comes from the smoothness of the vacuum. But we also had this second system very far away, the radiation system, the system of radiation. And we could, in this radiation system, so this late radiation has to be entangled. Well, we argue that it was maximally entangled because it's carrying, well, I'm going to argue now that this late radiation has to be maximally entangled with this system here far away. And the argument is that after this black hole evaporates completely, after it emits all the radiation that is left to emit, the whole state of the radiation, so the early radiation plus the radiation that is emitted, that will be emitted until the black hole evaporates, should form a pure state, because we formed the original black hole from a pure state. So this mode should be purified by some other qubit here. So there should be, we could distill in principle a qubit that is maximally entangled with the late radiation. Right? So that comes from the unitarity of the black hole evolution. Now, the paradox arises because it is impossible to have this late radiation maximally entangled with two different systems, both with the inner partner and with this qubit outside. So let me try to explain why that is impossible. Well, before explaining why it is impossible, I should say that Amps proposed their resolution. And their resolution is that these two are not entangled. And so we have a firewall at the horizon. Now, this is a proposed resolution of the paradox. I personally think it's probably not the right resolution. But you shouldn't confuse the resolution with the paradox. You shouldn't view this as an argument for a firewall. You should view this as a paradox for some that arises when you try to describe this system in some Hilbert space that contains all 3 degrees of freedom. And the reason this is not possible is related to the so-called entropy subadditivity inequality. And this is an inequality that is obeyed by generic quantum systems, where you have 3 systems, A, B, and C. So in this case, we have 3 systems, which are this, this, and this one. So here, C is this late radiation that's going to be entangled both with this and with that. And A is the inside partner, and B are the distilled qubits in this faraway system that are entangled with the late radiation. So here, we have And so this is what this inequality says, that the entropies of this joint system plus this one are bigger than these entropies. And this is in general, and I think there is a mathematical exercise to check this for some random density matrices. It's not the proof, but at least the check. Okay, so here I've just relabeled them so that so this is inside partner, this is the late radiation, this is the far away qubit, and so on. And now we'll calculate the sizes of each of these entropies. So first of all, we decided that these two are maximally entangled. So that means that, and also these two are maximally entangled. And that means that, so this maximal entanglement means that the entropy of this is close to zero. Okay. So that's what maximal entanglement means, that if you take the two systems together, they have close to zero entropy. It's close to a pure state. And that comes from the smoothness of the near horizon geometry. Then this other one, so the entanglement, so the fact that these two are entangled is also close to zero. And that's related to the unitarity of black hole evaporation. And finally, this guy here is non-zero due to the fact that we have a Hawking temperature. So we chose a mode where there was 50-50% chance of being occupied or not. So this one here will be, let's say, log of 2. So it will be a non-zero number. And, well, this one is something positive, so we don't care what it is. But you see, you cannot satisfy this inequality. So if these are both are, if the left-hand side is close to zero and the right-hand side is log of 2, then the inequality is not being obeyed. Okay? So we have a contradiction. Now, as a side comment, I should say that this strong additivity only holds when these three systems are spatially separated. So they don't hold if, let's say, two of the systems are time-like separated. So for example, in this case, where, let's say, A and B could be the same system but taken at different times, then there is no problem with having maximal entanglement between C and A and C and B. Okay, so that there, in this case, there is no problem. Now, this comment seems irrelevant because the three systems we described above seem to obviously be on the same spatial slice, right? There was a spatial slice that went through all three systems. Now, since the Amps paradox involved a maximally entangled black hole, let's study some examples of maximally entangled black holes. So that's what the topic we're going to turn into. But first, we'll do an apparent detour, so something that seems slightly disconnected, and we'll connect it later. So we'll discuss the simplest solution of Einstein's equations with spherical symmetry, of vacuum Einstein equations with spherical symmetry. It's so simple that it was derived 1 year after Einstein's paper, or very soon after Einstein's paper on general relativity. And of course, this full geometry was understood much later. It took about 60 years to understand it properly. But this is the geometry. So it, as I said, it's a very simple, basic geometry. It's the simplest solution of Einstein's equations. But it's rather strange. So it has some region, so the region here to the right, so the 45-degree lines are the horizons of some black holes, could be viewed as horizons of a black hole. And we have this right exterior region. So this region looks like the exterior of a black hole. So if you are sitting here, you see flat space, well, flat space far away, and in the middle, you see a black hole horizon. And this region to the left is also looks like the exterior of a black hole, so it looks like a completely different space-time with a black hole in the center. Okay. And the two black holes are joined through the horizon. So the horizon at this point of at this point in time, the two horizons coincide. And then later, the two horizons separate. And then you have this region here, which is we call the future interior. So the interior of the black hole is actually common to these two black holes. The exterior are not common. The exterior are two different spacetimes, but they are sharing an interior. Okay. What did I do? Okay. Okay. Good. And this surface here is called the Einstein-Rosen bridge. So Einstein and Rosen realized that these two were connected even before people realized that the horizon was not smooth. Actually, after people realized the horizon was smooth, but they didn't know that. This is the geometry of that Einstein-Rosen bridge. So you have three-dimensional. This is a slice at t equal to 0. So you have three-dimensional space, then a two-sphere that shrinks, but does not become shrinks up to the size of the horizon, and then expands again into a second three-dimensional space. So that's that solution. Now there are closely related solutions where you put these two black holes in the same space-time. So in the solution I've discussed so far, the two black holes are in two different space-times. But you can find an alternative solution where at some moment in time, you have these two black holes in the same space-time, separated by a very long distance. You can have a black hole here, another black hole in the Andromeda galaxy, let's say. But they are connected through the interior. Okay. So the geometry of these black holes is similar, especially near the horizon, is similar to a piece of the geometry we saw before. So we again find these two horizons which are touching, and we have a piece now of the Einstein-Rosen bridge, which is just this piece that joins this to this side. And these are solutions of general relativity. They are perfectly legal. Well, they are solutions that solve all the equations. And they look a bit like a wormhole, so in the sense that they connect regions that are very far away. But they are not like the science fiction wormholes. So the wormhole you see in the movie Interstellar, for example, it's an example, is a wormhole that allows you to travel, to actually physically travel to the faraway region. This is not a wormhole that allows you to do that, because if you try to travel from one to the other, so let's say you start here, and so let's say you start from a point here, which is 1 meter outside this black hole horizon, and you want to travel to a point which is 1 meter outside this black hole horizon. So at t equal to 0, the distance between these two points is, well, it's very far in the ambient space, but it's really only 2 meters through the wormhole. Okay. However, you start your journey, you go in, and this horizon starts moving away from you and at the speed of light, and you never catch up with it. And not only that, but this two-sphere we talked about starts closing on you, and you get to a singularity before you can reach the other side. So it doesn't allow you to travel. And in fact, you cannot send any signals using these wormholes. So they lead to no causality violation, right? I mean, you might have been worried that GR is based on the principle of relativity, based on the idea that no signals travel faster than light. But then you have these solutions which might allow you to send signals faster than light. But actually, the whole structure of the theory is such that this doesn't happen. It's a bit of a miracle. I mean, and it's true only for GR. So if you modify your equations, for example, there is one simple modification is to add an r squared, certain r squared terms in five dimensions. They are non-trivial. And for black holes in that, for this type of solutions in that theory, this is not true. So, so you can consider other theories where it's not true, but in general relativity it's true. And it depends on the null energy condition for matter. And the null energy condition is the idea that the T++ component of the stress tensor, so the stress tensor, let's say locally the value of P+, Lycon value, so energy minus the momentum should always be positive, even locally. Now that locally doesn't hold in quantum theory, but you need to take averages over along a null line. And even that is not always true in quantum theory, but if you take it for null lines, which such that no points are time-like separated along the null line, then it is true. Okay. At least no counterexample has been found. And just this condition is enough to show that you cannot send signals through wormholes. So people who want to claim that there exist science fiction wormholes have to violate this condition, which is pretty solidly, well, it's a pretty reasonable condition, and for which no counterexample exists. So when you read in popular books that, maybe in quantum theory, the null energy condition is not true, therefore I can have wormholes, well, you should tell them, well, this is true, and you shouldn't have wormholes. Anyway, so that's about wormholes. Now, we can have these wormholes even in anti-Sitter space. So it's basically the same story. It's almost identical to what we said before. And we can ask what the interpretation of these states is. And the idea is that such wormholes can be interpreted as an entangled state in two separated, not interacting field theories. So you have the dual quantum systems that live on the boundary. The boundaries are disconnected. They are two completely separate spaces. But we have a quantum state on this boundary, on this space, which is entangled. And the entangled state is a very particular one. It's called the thermofield double. And I'll discuss why it's called like that. So it's called like that because it has a form similar to the form you get for the canonical ensemble. So it's a form very closely related to the canonical ensemble form. So you take the temperature and you sum over all the energy eigenstates in such a way that an energy eigenstate in the right system is correlated with the energy eigenstate on the left system. And it's called thermofield double because if you trace out over the left, so you say, let's say we only make observations on the right system, and then even though this is a pure state, if we only make observations on the right system, then we'll get a density matrix in the right system. And that density matrix will be just the canonical density matrix, so the density matrix for the system in the canonical ensemble. And this construction for field theories is useful for some purposes, some theoretical purposes, let's say. So here we see that when we entangle the states, we apparently generate this connection between the two sides. And of course, the entanglement entropy is equal to the area of the black hole. So this is a concrete example where we can understand the black hole entropy as coming from entanglement. Now, there is a piece of the black hole entropy that comes from considering the quantum fields on these slice, and we are dividing these slice into two parts, the part that is on this side and the part that is on that side. And if we did that in quantum field theory, we would get an infinity, but an infinity which is of order one in the G Newton expansion. But using gravity, we and doing the Gibbons-Hawking computation, for example, get a finite answer, which is of order one over G Newton, which is classically more important than this infinite correction. And we should think of that infinite correction as being regularized by gravity, by this answer. So now we can go back to these classical solutions that were, we could go back to these classical solutions, these wormhole-like solutions, and say that, well, even when they exist in the same space-time, we should interpret them as entangled black holes in the same space-time. And we call this ER equal to EPR in the sense that Einstein-Rosen bridges are created whenever we have EPR correlations. Now, just to make more clear what we are talking about, let's imagine we have two people who are sent to, let's call them Romeo and Juliet, who are sent to too far away. Their families don't want them to meet. And so one is kept here in our galaxy, and the other one is sent to the Andromeda galaxy. And but they get hold of some entangled qubits, and they classically communicate, they send messages, and they build two black holes that are in this state, two entangled black holes. And then they can now, if they build them in this particular thermofield double state, then the idea is that they can jump into their respective black holes, and the observers outside will just see them falling into the black holes and just dying, right? So they committed suicide. But they could meet in the interior. Okay. But the observers outside just end the tale the same way as Shakespeare, but there's a little afterlife where they actually were together. Now, so what are the lessons of this? So the lessons is that entanglement of the two black holes generates a geometric connection. And I think this has an important lesson for space-time, because a popular picture of space-time is that space-time is a kind of elastic membrane, right? It's some kind of medium, continuum medium that can have fluctuations. But something a membrane will not do is that if you have some entangled system here and there, and they are entangled, it will not create the membrane will just not reconnect and reconnect itself just only because you had entanglement. But in the case of black holes, and this particular black holes, it seems to be true. Another feature is that the interior does not belong to any of the two black holes. So the interior is shared between the two black holes. So it cannot be correct to say that the interior is the same as the exterior qubits, or the degrees of freedom of the exterior, or the quantum degrees of freedom that make the black hole, because in this case, the interior is shared between the two. Right? So should I construct the interior in terms of the operators of one black hole, or the microstates of one black hole, or the microstates of the other? Right? It has to be made jointly somehow. So they cannot be described in terms of one or the other set of microstates. Okay. So now let's go back to our discussion of the Amps paradox and try to apply this knowledge that we just discussed. And let's imagine that we take this early radiation, this faraway system, and instead of distilling one particular qubit to be maximally entangled with the other, let's say we take this whole radiation and imagine there is an incredibly powerful quantum computer. It's not clear that it can be done, but let's imagine it could be done, at least for the sake of the argument, that you produce a second black hole, which is in a thermofield double state with the first one. So it is something that, at least in principle, is possible in the sense that these two objects are maximally entangled, and you can certainly do operations, quantum computer-type operations, on the radiation to take this entangled state into any other maximally entangled state, such as the thermofield double. So suppose you do that. What do we conclude? Well, we would get a picture roughly like this. These two things are unchanged. So the inside partner and the late radiation is really unchanged. But now the faraway system corresponds to the left side of the diagram. And in this diagram, this late radiation is entangled with a qubit in the far system. It's that qubit written there in the bottom. But now you see something interesting. So the inside partner is actually to the future of this far, far away system. And so they are time-like separated. So no one forbids you to have maximal entanglement between these two. So before we ran into trouble because the late radiation had to be both maximally entangled with the far system and with the interior partner. But now there is no problem because they are time-like separated through the interior of the wormhole. Okay. So that's the picture if you were to do this with the radiation. Now, suppose you didn't do anything with the radiation. What should be the picture? Well, we don't really know what the picture is, so we drew this sketch. So the idea is that you have the radiation here, which is composed of single qubits, and you have very tiny little wormholes which do not have a geometric description. But they all join together to form some smooth interior. We don't really know what this picture means, but we think, except to say that it is possible, in principle, to send signals behind the black hole horizon by doing operations with the radiation. And so, in principle, I think this is an important element for understanding the interior and the black hole paradoxes. It doesn't resolve the paradox. Well, it resolves a little bit that version of the paradox, but it creates other problems. Because the question is, now if I modify this radiation by just kicking one of the little qubits, does it immediately send a signal behind the horizon? Does it destroy the horizon, or what does it do? And for understanding what exactly it does depends on the structure of this wormhole. So the wormhole we discussed so far had a moment where the two horizons touched each other. But you can find that if you start modifying the entangled state to take it away from the thermofield double to consider more generic entangled states, then the two horizons start separating from each other. And it is likely that the generic situation is when the two horizons are very far from each other, so that sending simple signals from one do not reach the region behind the horizon of the first. So that would be a setup in which you could have a smooth horizon despite this entanglement. And then the process of distilling the qubits would produce the particle behind the horizon. So, but we don't know really the rules for building these wormholes, and so we don't really know these wormholes. So what we, the way I think things stand now is that this ER equal to EPR is a principle that the theory of quantum gravity should obey. And as an exercise, you should construct the interior so that this is true. And there are simple ideas for doing this which don't work. So the Amps paradoxes tell you they don't work. So you have to be, you have to evade these Amps paradoxes. And there are some proposals for these constructions that are not generally accepted. So I won't discuss them. But if you ask me later, I can tell you. So I'll finish with something that was talked about in the school, which was these tensor networks. And as we saw in the talks by Vidal, tensor networks construct the wave function of a state. And they have a certain topology and geometry, which is dictated by the patterns of entanglement in the state. So its construction depends in a strong way on entanglement. And for example, you have this Mera construction, which is useful for scaling variant theories. And we talked about this morning. So here, for those who were not here this morning, you imagine here a one-dimensional field theory. And so we're trying to define the wave function. And each line here in the bottom is the plus or minus of the qubit. That's some local degree of freedom of one-dimensional system with a scaling variant infrared fixed point. And then you construct this wave function in terms of some tensors. So each vertex is a tensor with five indices. And this is a particular ansatz for the wave function, which encodes the entanglement properties. So here, if you have two qubits that are near each other, they are, so there is a large amount of entanglement. So these two, well, so we have these indices that are close to each other connecting them. But as you get further and further in the network, there are, in some sense, fewer indices that connect them. And so you have a weaker amount of entanglement at longer distances. And this has the properties of scaling variance that you expect and so on. Now, the one reason I'm bringing up these tensor networks is because in the tensor network description, we really have this, I should say one more thing. So the structure of this tensor network is reminiscent of the geometry of ADS space, and this was pointed out by Swingle. And so it's tempting to think that in the same way that the tensor network constructs the wave function, that the gravity, the geometry, also constructs the wave function. And they are somehow related constructions. The geometry is a particular kind of tensor network with further special properties. So, and one reason this is I like this tensor network picture is that it obeys somehow this ER equal to EPR principle in the sense that let's suppose that you add two excitations. Let's say you have the field theory and you add two local excitations, but they are, so you don't consider the vacuum, but you consider the wave function of a state that has some excitations that are entangled with each other. They're far away and entangled with each other. So if they're entangled with each other, you would describe them by a network that has some additional connections, so some index that is summed over these long ranges. And this is reminiscent of these wormholes that connect the regions far away. These are just pictures, but they are suggestive pictures. So in some sense, these tensor networks have the skeleton of what you would need for the ER equal to EPR connection. Now, conclusions. So we have a reasonable picture for black holes as seen from the outside. We are confused about the interior. There's an interesting connection between chaos and the near horizon geometry of a black hole. Again, this is a connection that has to do purely with the black hole as seen from the outside. And we've seen that there is a close connection between wormholes and EPR. And it is tempting to think that whenever you have some EPR pair, you have some tiny little wormholes that connect them. And so that entanglement can create geometric connections. Two far away entangled systems are in some sense close close by through a wormhole. Again, a wormhole that does not allow you to transmit signals. As of course, with entanglement, you cannot transmit signals. And also, finally, I discussed tensor networks have some similarities to the dual geometry. And I really only scratched the surface. There are some interesting work that's been done by Harlow and collaborators showing how you can use these tensor networks together with some ideas of quantum error correction to build the ADS geometry and so on. Okay, thank you.
Very good. So we have time for questions. Maybe we start first with students, if I understand correctly. That's the tradition. Don't be shy. We really have lots of time. I was counting on hour 15. So.
Yeah.
So you mentioned about different proposals of constructing the black hole interior. Do you maybe want to say a few things about what you think is the most promising direction?
Yeah, so I there is this proposal of Raju and Papadudimas. So this is a proposal based on the following idea. So imagine you have, so let's first discuss Rindler space so that we understand what we're talking about. So imagine that that we have the usual entangled state. So we have some creation operators for Rindler modes here. So let's call this the right and this the left. And so we have some B dagger right, which creates modes here on the right. And then we have the B dagger left that creates modes here on the left. And the Minkowski space vacuum is equal to e to the minus, so if these have some energy E, so it's given by a formula like this, acting on the Rindler vacuum. So we have the Rindler vacuum, which is a product of zero left and zero right, which are annihilated by the annihilation operators. So these are states which are annihilated by B left, right? And the same for B right. And then the Minkowski vacuum is this particular entangled state constructed. So this is an entangled state of the two systems. And one thing you notice here is that if you, let's imagine we want to define some operator here on the left, right? Let's say we know we have access to the operators here on the right. So we understand what an operator here on the right is, and we want to define an operator acting here on the left. Then something you notice is that if, let's say we act with the annihilation operator here on the left, on the Minkowski vacuum, right? Do you think this is going to be zero? It's an annihilation operator acting on the vacuum. Is it zero? So it's not zero because it's not the Minkowski annihilation operator. It's this Rindler annihilation operator. Right? And here we have the explicit expression. And we see that from the point of view of B dagger, so this does not commute only with B dagger. This B right dagger is a number. We could view it as a number from the point of view. And when you have a situation like this, so let's consider an auxiliary problem where this is acting on a state which is B dagger left, acting on the vacuum left, right? So what is the action of this operator, right? It just brings down a power of alpha, right? And so here, alpha is this whole thing. So this is e to the minus beta e over 2, B right dagger acting on the 0m, OK? So if we don't know how B left acts, well, we could just define B left to be this particular action, right? And in the same way, we can define B right. So be right is defined by a similar formula. It's be dagger right. I mean, sorry. We need to define be left and be dagger left. So we have now be dagger left acting on the Minkowski vacuum. Then it's essentially the inverse of the formula we just used. So we have here an e to the minus, maybe there's a minus sign here, I don't remember, beta e over 2, b right, acting on Minkowski. Okay. So we can represent the action of the operators here by these particular operators on the right-hand side. Okay. Good. Now, this is just in Minkowski space. But this also would be true in, let's say, a black hole background. So let's say now we have a black hole. For example, it could be a black hole in ADS. So now we have the black hole in ADS. And everything I said here would still be correct in the quantum field theory around this background. Okay. Now, I said that we understand how to describe the exterior of a black hole. So for any of these operators, B left, B right, or B right dagger, right, that we insert in the exterior of the black hole, we think that we have a construction, or we do have some at least perturbative construction, of the corresponding operator in the boundary theory. So in the boundary theory, we have some Hilbert space H on the boundary. And we know how to translate B to some operator O right that acts on the Hilbert space of the right boundary. Okay, so we have this translation. It's some specific operators that make out of the qubits that live here on the boundary. So now let's imagine. So okay, good. So what Rajiv Papadimas said, they said the following. So let's imagine we have some state. So let's say the black hole is in a pure state. And it's some particular generic microstate chi. And the microstate chi is such that it's basically indistinguishable from the thermal state for when we calculate the expectation values of simple operators. Okay, so a few of these Bs and B daggers, for example. So then they said, the challenge is to give a construction here for the operators on the left that does what is supposed to do. Well, let's construct them so that they are exactly what, they have exactly these properties. So they said, well, you want me to construct some operator B left. Okay, so I want to tell you we need to know how B left acts on the vacuum. Okay, so we'll define B left to be some operator which acting on the vacuum, it produces, it gives the same answer as, e to the minus beta e over 2 is the energy of these operators, b dagger, right, acting on chi. Okay. So as I said, we know how to think of the right operators in terms of operators in the CFT. Okay. And then we define simply the operators acting on the vacuum through this formula. Okay. And in this way, you can define the operator so you can act again with another B left or with a B left dagger. And so once you translated this into this state, then you act with B left. It's supposed to commute with this. You act again here, and you use the formula again. And you can see that in this way, you can define this for any number of operators you can have here. So this is designed in such a way that it would reproduce whatever you would get from a smooth horizon. Okay, so there is no question that this construction will give you what you expect from a smooth horizon. Now, why is not everyone convinced by this construction? The reason is that the operator defined this way depends in a sensitive way on what the state is. So, viewed as an operator in the original Hilbert space, this is an operator which depends on the state chi. Okay, so it's so we have that the operator O left, right? So the operators that act, B left, translate into some operator which depends in a non-linear way on what this chi is. Okay, so it depends on chi. But in ordinary quantum mechanics, we have that the operator should be independent of states. So we have operators which are some matrix, some fixed matrix, and we can apply this fixed matrix on various states. So we don't have operators which depend on the state. So it would be a nonlinear construction. That's more or less where things stand. So what one imagines that one would want a construction in which these operators are state independent, so they are fixed matrices, and I'm sure that such constructions are doomed to fail. And so they said, well, let's make them state dependent. Now this, let me try to put this problem in a. The problem with this construction in a simple way. Okay, I call this the track problem. Okay, so by acting with a unitary operator here, you can create a track that travels in this direction. This is the track. Okay, track going this way. You can do this with a unitary operator that only modifies the interior. Okay, and. So from the point of view of the outside, this state looks the same as the previous state. So this is the track creation operator, right? We have the track creation operator chi. This is some other chi prime that looks, from the outside, looks identical to the previous one. Okay? And so from the outside, you would also define these operators, B left and blah, 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 the same as you would have done before. So you define another operator. B, let me call it B. So the new B left operator is different because it refers to the state chi prime. So let me call it B left prime. And this is just given by acting with, so it's the same as B left times T dagger. Maybe these are the other way around, so you figure out which way they are. But so it's not the same as the previous operator, so that's simply the statement. Well, this operator is state dependent. Depends on the state we consider. But now, suppose I come in here and I cross the path of this track, right? So if I had made my construction on this operator, I should feel nothing. Okay? So if I think that I'm going to be described by the operator B prime, right? Then I feel nothing. If I think I'm going to be described by the operator B, which was the one in the original vacuum, I feel that I should hit the track. Okay. So what's the right answer? Okay, is there a principle that tells me what the right answer is? Well, so you could say, well, if you could attempt the following out. You could say, well, if I'm ignorant, I don't care if the track comes or not. I will just feel nothing. Okay. So this leads to the new advice that mothers should give to their children or fathers, which is if you are going to cross the street, don't look. Because if you look, then you know the truck is coming, might hit you. But if you don't look, you are ignorant, you won't feel anything. So that's one way of putting what is strange about this proposal. Right? Now, you can say, well, maybe there is some rule for what states we can consider here and so on. So. These are some of the problems. This is the main problem with this issue, or problems in this direction. On the other hand, so that's a problem. But let me say something now in favor of the proposal. Okay. Now, if we want to have a smooth horizon, right? And we know that if we have a smooth horizon, certainly these equations are true. So if we want to say that any state has a smooth horizon, how can this construction be wrong? I mean, it is just demanding what we think is true. Right? I think if it is wrong, it's because we are not thinking properly about how to construct the Hilbert space here in the interior. So this operator should not be acting on the Hilbert space of microstate, should be acting on something else. Yeah.
plays track by Juliet, then you resolve the problem in this sense. It will be a feature, not a problem.
Right. So indeed, they have also this. So this was a discussion for the one-sided black hole, right? Because we have a pure state here on the right. You can also make a construction for the two-sided black hole. And for the two-sided black hole, the construction would be a bit different and would be such that indeed you can meet when you go through and so on. But the construction is slightly different for the one-sided and the two-sided black hole. I'm not sure if... So... It was important here in this construction that we started with a pure state on the right, right? The two-sided black hole does not have a pure state on the right. It has a pure state for both systems.
More questions?
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah, that's right. So only in a vague sense, in the sense that to the extent that the canonical ensemble is the same as the microcanonical ensemble, then it's maximally entangled. But of course, for very high energy states are not entangled strongly. Thank you for clarifying that.
So in this Romeo and Juliet scenario, they have to be very careful with how they prepare this two-way black hole thing. What happens if they make a slight error? Do they still come in the same black hole, or?
Right. So. So you could think that if they make, so if you think about this surface here, right? And so you could make small changes on this surface, and you still have the same black hole. But if you make a small change here in the far past, right? Then it translates into a big change here in the future. So there's a question of when you should think of Romeo and Juliet making this state, right? Should we think of them as making the state here, or? So if you think that they make the state by sending in particles from the very far past, they really have to be extremely careful, exponentially careful in how they send them. So your question brings me to another point, which is you could take the following point of view. So you could say, I'm going to ignore everyone this guy is saying about entangled black holes because you can never make them. Okay, that would be somewhat reasonable point of view. There are some arguments that it's very difficult to, if you have two entangled systems, to purify the qubits, for example, even to run the original Amps paradox. It's an argument by Harlow and Hayden. They say that it takes an exponentially large amount of time to purify that qubit that we discussed before. And well, making a second black hole is like purifying all the possible qubits of the black hole, so it's even harder. So you could say, well, all these things don't matter, and it is a possibility, yes. But I view them as telling us something that is non-trivial and probably is a lesson we should learn. I mean, after all, it's the simplest solution.
Another question. So in your speak, you said that a person in the interior of black hole can send signals outside by manipulating some operators or some particles, right? So this disobeys the classical picture. So it is that the classical picture is wrong or something else? And another question is that.
No, let's start with the first question, one question at a time. So
okay,
you were asking, so I was talking about signals.
Yes.
And I was talking about classical signals, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so, well, when I was talking about Hawking radiations, those were quantum fields, right, in that part of the argument. When I was talking about Romeo and Juliet, yeah, they were classical objects. I'm not sure exactly what the question was. Were you bothered by the fact that they were classical? Or?
So I mean, in quantum picture, the person in the interior of the black hole can send signals outside, but exactly. In the classical picture, this is forbidden. So
in the classical picture, they cannot send signals. And what makes you think that in the quantum picture they can?
So let me
show you something. So imagine that you send, there is Romeo here, you send him here, right? Are you saying that Romeo can send a signal to Juliet?
Right.
This should not be possible, right? Because these are just entangled states. So Romeo goes in, does something, whatever he does, he should not be able to send the signal to Juliet. Okay.
I think so.
Yeah.
Ah.
Okay. That was the question.
So my question is: can somebody in the interior black hole send classical message outside?
Send the message outside?
Yes.
Well, so if the interior is an interior like this of the two-sided black hole, and if the person that is sending the message is one that came in purely from the left, then he should not be able to send a signal, right? Now, on the other hand, if you have someone who falls in with the intention of sending a signal, well, in this case, presumably it is possible, you would think. But here it's not clear whether what you are seeing is the signal he sent or the fact that he had the intention of sending the signal. Or exactly.
But he can send the message through Hawking radiation, right?
The question you're asking is, if I collect the Hawking radiation, can I detect what this person did inside the black hole, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the question. So that question is equivalent to the question of can we reconstruct the interior of the black hole? And as I was mentioning, it's not there isn't a construction that doesn't run into some paradoxes. Yeah, let me. So the answer is we don't have a construction that answers this question. Yeah.
In the denser network picture, you discussed entanglement between two excited states.
Yes.
But can you also have an entanglement between an excited state and an unexcited spin? Which would imply that not only black holes are entangled, but also particles or black holes with space-time degree freedom.
I mean, at the level of tensor networks, there is no problem in entangling whatever you want, right? Of course, if you have the vacuum state, that's just a single state, so you cannot entangle it with another system that has more than one state, right? So I think what you have in mind is a situation where you entangle let's say you have some sub-region, which looks indistinguishable from the vacuum, with a second system, right? And yeah, that in principle you could do. You could take, for example, this Mera construction, let's say, or the corresponding ADS discussion, right? And let's say you have some region here, and you have the corresponding set of links here, which you cut. So as was discussed today, if you are interested in the density matrix here, right, you only care about the tensors in some region, right? So you could take these tensors, and then here you entangle with something else, some completely different system, right? And so in that case, you have something which does not differ from the vacuum in this region, but is entangled with something else.
One question here, and then perhaps one more.
Yeah.
What can we learn observationally about black holes that can verify or falsify your theoretical proposals?
The question is whether by observation you can, by observing real black holes? No. This whole discussion applies for these quantum aspects of black holes, which I mentioned in the first transparency are very small for the real black holes. Now, even if they were bigger, one thing you could check is whether the black hole formation and evaporation is a unitary process. It's very difficult, and but it could be done with very small black holes. Right? So in some, not with astrophysical black holes, you cannot check any of these quantum aspects. Okay, that's a zero story. You could, in principle, check if you are willing to commit suicide. You could go and fall into an astrophysical black hole and check whether the horizon is smooth or not. Okay? So you would be able to, let's say, go into a supermassive black hole and check whether the horizon is smooth or not, but you wouldn't be able to tell anyone outside. At least we don't know how to tell someone outside. It was related to the question that was asked before, whether you could tell someone outside what happened to you. So that's for astrophysical black holes. Now, for the question of whether black holes, evolution, formation, and evaporation is unitary, again, you could do it only if you form small enough black holes so that the process of checking this is not too complicated. And the question of whether you can form these small black holes depends on what nature, how nature behaves. I mean, there was at some point the idea that you could make black holes in the LHC, and if you could have done that, which you cannot, you would have been able to do it, but maybe you can do it in the next collider. So it's a question that depends on the laws of nature. Now, I should also say that you can definitely falsify the idea that the universe is described by quantum mechanics, right? By simply performing any tabletop experiments that falsifies quantum mechanics. So, and if such experiment was done, then all of string theory would be wrong, which is based on the idea that the universe is described by quantum mechanics. But regarding the different theories for the interior of the black hole, unfortunately, the only guide we have is some kind of consistency. So it's not understood well enough even at the level of theory that what theoretical construction makes sense. And we are just guided by it should be consistent, it should be consistent with everything else we know, it should be consistent also with cosmology, for example, with the horizons we have in cosmology. And that's some of the principles that we have. And I think that understanding the interior is the beginning of trying to understand the cosmological space-times, because an interior looks like a cosmology. It looks like a big crunch space-time. And so hopefully, so the motivations for studying this problem are basically theoretical for trying to understand quantum gravity, and the basic tools we have is consistency. But unfortunately, we don't have experiment to guide us here.
We should thank Juan. And